Right page. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 1, text 9. Anye cha bhava shura. Madarte tyakta jivitaha. Nana shastra praharana. Sarve yuddha visharadaha. Anye cha bhava shura. Madarte tyakta jivitaha. Nana shastra paharana. Sarve yuddha visharadaha. Translation. There are many other heroes who are prepared to lay down their lives for my sake. All of them are well equipped with different kinds of weapons, and all are experienced in military science. Purport. As far as the others are concerned, like Jayadratha, Kritavarma, and Shalya, all are determined to lay down their lives for Duryodhana's sake. In other words, it is already concluded that all of them would die. In the battle of Kurukshetra, for joining the party of the sinful Duryodhana, Duryodhana was, of course, confident of his victory on account of the above-mentioned combined strength of his friends. Bhagavad Gita is famous as the instruction of Bhagavan, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to Arjuna. Thus it's known as Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This first chapter introduces the topics, and actually this particular verse which we've read today is spoken by Duryodhana, who is a baddie. He's a number one bad guy. But it's all included in Bhagavad Gita, and there is, even from the words of a person who is not self-realized, it's included in Bhagavad Gita, we may extract some understanding. We're supposed to follow Bhagavad Gita. This particular section, or this particular statement, that all are expert in fighting, that's not meant for devotees, not meant to fight among themselves, as the Kauravas were doing. We speak about the Kauravas and the Pandavas, but actually the Pandavas were also Kauravas inasmuch as they were descendants of Kuru. Of course, devotees should be, those who are preaching Krishna consciousness, they should be expert in doing so. That's another kind of fighting. Srila Prabhupada often spoke of fighting for Krishna in the sense of not his own mission. He spoke much about fighting, not physically fighting, but fighting all the demonic and atheistic ideas that are misleading people. This first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is, in Sanskrit, it's often given the title Arjuna Vishada Yoga, the Yoga of the Lamentation of Arjuna. Of course, Arjuna's lamentation could be more accurately described as Viyoga. Yoga means attachment, linking, and Arjuna is dislinked, therefore Viyoga, from his actual duty from Krishna by doing so. These words yoga and viyoga are used in arithmetic. Yoga means addition and viyoga means subtraction. In up to the present day, in Hindi derived, well, it is Sanskrit. So Arjuna laments, seeing all the great fighters, those who are expert, and foreseeing the carnage ahead, Arjuna lamented. He became a sentimentalist, which was not befitting a kshatriya, as Krishna will tell Arjuna. This comes at the beginning of the second chapter. Klaibyang masmakam aparata. Vishame samupastita anarya jushta masvargama kirti karam Arjuna. Krishna tells Arjuna, this is not befitting you. This is the way you're talking, it's like a eunuch. In this terrible condition, in this terrible situation, that's what kshatriyas are meant for. They're meant for going into terrible situations. So Krishna chastised Arjuna as being anarya, someone who is not interested in the higher values of life. So this lamentation of Arjuna, that is on the platform of a shudra. One definition of a shudra is shochati iti shudra, one who laments. Shochati iti shudra, one who laments is a shudra. It means he has no philosophical understanding of the nature of reality. He thinks that his life is meant for sense gratification, and if he's thwarted in his sense gratification, which inevitably he will be, because that is the nature of this material world, this is something lamentable, and therefore he laments. So Krishna chastised Arjuna for sinking to the level of a shudra. Of course, that's in Bhagavad Gita chapter 1. And the rest of the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna giving knowledge to Arjuna and straightening him out, clearing his misconceptions. Now, persons who for the first time are exposed, either by reading or hearing, the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, would probably think that Arjuna has got a very good case. Why should he fight with his relatives? Why should he cause women to be unprotected by the slaughter of so many kshatriyas? Arjuna, he was lamenting. And most readers, having not heard Krishna's, what at first might seem shocking, admonition of Arjuna, would sympathize with Arjuna. Seems like what he's saying is right. But as Krishna will point out to Arjuna, Arjuna was on the platform of ignorance of his actual duty, on the platform of being a spirit soul and an eternal servant of Krishna, and meant to act according to the will of Krishna. Arjuna was in ignorance of this. Therefore, he was on the platform of lamentation, or the sentimental platform, we could say that Arjuna had become highly empathetic to the Kauravas. We hear a lot about this word empathy, empathetic listening and empathetic behavior, see the other side and all this kind of thing. But here in Bhagavad Gita, we find that Krishna in this circumstance rejects this. As Arjuna was supposed to be an Arya, one who understands the higher principles of life, but he had simply come down to the emotional platform, the emotional platform of complete ignorance. So to overcome this our emotional attachment to the material world, which binds us in this material world, it's not just gross sense gratification, but it's attachment to this material world that binds us within it. That attachment, that is ato griha kshetra sutapta vitaya, we become attached not only to our body, but also to the particular house that we might live in, to the land in which we are born. God bless America. And there are variants of that all over the world. God bless England, there's something like that. In England's green and pleasant land, and did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's pastures green, something like this. William Blake imagined that Jesus had come to England. So this, the land we're born in, ato griha kshetra, to our children, to our relatives and friends, to our money, these material attachments, we become emotionally attached to them. Just like if a person learns that he had $1 million and then all his stocks became evaporated, he had $1 million in stocks and became evaporated overnight, he'd become very upset. Why? It's just some, what is the nature of that? It's just something typed in a computer. And he had previously, when he had $1 million worth of stocks, he had the potential to withdraw that and spend it. Now if $1 million is reduced to $2 overnight, then he doesn't have the same potential. But what did he lose, actually? It's not something that he was utilizing. It's just the idea, the attachment to the idea that I can enjoy. Or if someone has gold, are you allowed to keep gold in this country? Is it legal to stock gold? It is. Okay, I'm just asking, because in merry old England, where I come from, it's illegal to have more than one coin of gold. I guess you'd have a wedding ring also. So if you have a chest full of gold bars and someone steals it, they may feel very upset. But what did you lose, actually? What can you do with it? I mean, what do you want to do? Eat it, suck it, lick it, put it on your head? What can you do, actually, with gold? Well, that's the idea, that you can. It's potential money. But as long as you're not using it, then what have you got? What is the actual use of it? It's simply emotional attachment to the idea that I am a rich man because I have a chest full of gold bars. So it's emotional attachment to an imagination. And someone becomes very upset if he loses that. So just as Arjuna was very upset at the prospect of losing his fellow fighters, the people he knew, his cousins, friends, sons, inasmuch as persons like Lakshman, the son of Duryodhana, his nephew was on the platform of a son, his gurus and elders. So, but as Krishna will point out, anyway you're going to lose that anyway, because they're all going to die, you're all going to die, these bodies are going to die. So you won't remain in this situation anyway. Or if you take it around the other way, no one's going to die because everyone's a spirit soul. So if you think in terms of the body, you can't stop losing it. You can't stop losing that, the particular personalities who we identify with those bodies. And if we think in terms of the soul, then we're never going to lose them. They're never going to be killed. So either way, it doesn't make any sense to lament. This will be explained by Krishna. And Arjuna will eventually submit to Krishna. Nashto moha smritya labdha tvat prasadan maya achuta stito smigata sandeha karishe vachanam tava. Arjuna says to Krishna that by your mercy, Achuta, you who never fall into maya like me, by your mercy, all my doubts have been dispelled and my illusion is destroyed. Now I'm fixed in my proper situation and I'm prepared to follow your order. So this Bhagavad Gita, we're supposed to go beyond the first chapter and not remain in first chapter consciousness, simply lamenting, oh, my friends, oh, my country, oh, are lamenting for anything on the material platform. We're supposed to come to the spiritual understanding. In the present time, the 2000 and, what do we call this decade? The 2010s? It's like you talk about the 1960s, the 1970s. What do you call it? The 2000... The 2010s. Okay. Well, of course it didn't begin in this decade, but there's this whole New Age movement. It's not really a movement because it's not organized or as a movement or clearly definable, but it's one of those things which you're not really sure what it is, but if you talk about it, you have more or less everyone has some idea what it is. So there's a lot of talk about consciousness raising. Have you heard this? Consciousness raising. But as it's on the platform of the body and the mind, it's consciousness raising from that of being a gross and vicious animal to that of being a more empathetic animal. Instead of being like a tiger who is not empathetic to the zebras or gazelles or whatever creatures they hunt and kill, there's the idea of being empathetic, being nice to people, being kind to people. But it's all on the mundane platform. So it is, as Krishna says, anarya jushta, not fitting for a person on the higher platform of life. It means that at best, by coming to this platform of New Age, wishy-washy, be-niceness, one at best one has come up from the Chandala platform to the Shudra platform, because it's, again, it's on the emotional platform. It's not on this platform of spiritual understanding. It's emotional, sentimental. And even persons who take the role of spiritual guides, most of them are Shudras in the dress of Brahmanas. In other words, a Brahmana is supposed to lead human society, but if they simply talk in terms of emotional fulfillment, personal development, and feeling good, feeling nice, getting in contact with the baby within you and all this kind of thing, then it's all on the platform of the mind, the ignorant mind, the mind that is uninformed, in other words, ignorant of its of our true spiritual need. And these Shudras in the dress of Brahmanas, while emphasizing our emotional and sentimental needs, they will always put our feelings first, but not rules and regulations. They won't tell us that, they won't emphasize that we have to follow this rule and that rule to be even human beings, what to speak of being self-realized devotees of Krishna. For them, rules and regulations, they perceive it because they're Shudras. They perceive rules and regulations as being an imposition upon our plans to enjoy this material world. And therefore, we hear such things being said, within what is supposed to be the International Society for Krishna Consciousness also, statements such as, first love and then teach. In other words, you have to show the kind of affection that a mother feels for her child or a dog owner has for his dog, and then you can teach. But it's the back-to-frontness of contemporary Western society, just like we see that in the Western world, there's the idea that first you love someone, then you marry them, if you marry them. Whereas in traditional societies, you marry and then you discharge your duty and the affection develops. So in the West, we have first love, then marry, then divorce, then love someone else, or you might start loving them before you divorce, and it goes on and on and on, and they have no real idea of what love is at all. So this idea, first you love and then you teach, but actually, why should anyone teach unless they love? This idea that teaching is some imposition on others, it's done by people who want to exploit and control. No, someone teaches because they want to uplift them. That in it, the motive to teach someone, to give them knowledge by which they may be benefited, that in itself is a symptom of love. And the teacher has to expect discipline. That's also not there in our modern insane world, that teachers are not allowed to discipline students. And how can they teach them anything? Or how can they teach them even the most important thing, which is to offer respect to seniors, without which they can't begin to learn anything? So in traditional schools, discipline comes first, not so-called gushy emotional love. First, the student should become submissive, and unlike the children, children are by nature wild and uncontrolled, and if they don't get what they want, they'll just start screaming, literally. They are to be trained to, at least to operate in human society, they are to be trained so as they're not so grossly egoistic as a baby is. They're to be trained, they're to be disciplined. But this idea, first you love and then you can teach. If there's no acceptance on the part of the student of the superiority of the teacher, actually this word teacher is not there in Vedic culture, it's not much used. You can use the word shikshak, but the word guru is there. And with the concept of guru comes a whole package of cultural understanding that the guru is to be respected as good as God. So if there's no respect for the teacher, then actually education cannot take place. There might be some giving or imparting of some information, but real teaching, which means to real teaching begins with character training. So this idea, first you love and then you teach, it just springs from a total misunderstanding of the purpose of life and of how human beings should interact to fulfill the purpose of life. And maybe as it's applied within ISKCON, it's in counteraction or to the disciplined atmosphere that Srila Prabhupada instituted within his society, which is necessary for spiritual understanding. Then another popular saying, if you cannot win the heart, then you cannot win the brain. So there's all this idea, we have to win the heart, and then... But what is the heart? The heart of most people, they don't know what it is. They take their egoism to be their heart. So you'll find someone trying to win someone else's heart, and they're doing this dance around someone's egoistic ideas. But the process to deal with such egoism is, according to Shastra, to cut it. Santa evasya chindanti manovya sangam uktibihi. As Krishna states in Srimad Bhagavatam, the saintly persons cut the attachments born of the mind by their words. So this idea, first you win the heart. If you can't win the heart, you can't win the brain. Well, it's not according to Shastra. It may appeal to our egoism, but it's not according to Shastra. And it promotes this kind of superficial dealings in which everyone's just all nice to each other. Arjuna might have proposed, oh, let's go and shake hands with Duryodhana and say, well, okay, Duryodhana, actually, you're not such a jerk as you seem to be. Actually, you're a nice guy. Take the kingdom and do whatever you like with it, and we won't interfere with you. Why should we? But that's not what Krishna wanted. Arjuna wanted to compromise with Duryodhana, but Krishna didn't want him to. Krishna wanted him to fight. Krishna didn't say to Arjuna, you win Duryodhana's heart. He told him, you go and fight with him. He's a rascal. Then some more sayings from the wisdom of the fools. Everybody has a reason to do what he is doing, and so we must try to understand it. Yeah, Hitler had a reason. He outlined it in a whole big book, his reasons, but those reasons were demoniac. So why should we try to understand it? That book is such a bad book that it's banned for sale in many countries, probably in this country. Also, you don't see. It's not banned? It's not. In Germany it's banned, yeah. Mein Kampf. So, it's all based on the idea that Jews are the problem. Therefore, the solution is, well, get rid of the problem, literally. That's a major theme of that book, which I haven't read, but so we're told. Don't be judgmental. If someone says, don't be judgmental, that means if they say it to you, they're being judgmental about you. Because they've judged that you're being judgmental. It's one of those impossible statements, like I said last night. I never tell the truth. It's an impossible, you can't find any truth in this statement, because if what I say is true, then what I said is not true. And if what I say is not true, then it's also not true. So telling someone you shouldn't be judgmental is being judgmental of them. It's like that saying, you should be humble. So is it humble to tell someone they should be humble? A guru can say so to his disciple, but not otherwise. Learn to listen. I heard this the other day in a class in our temple in Los Angeles, that one of the greatest parts of preaching is just to listen to others. But actually, I don't find that Srila Prabhupada sat and listened for on and on and on to people talking all nonsense. If they're talking nonsense, he would point it out. That is his duty. Simply to listen to others talk nonsense is not the duty of a preacher. His duty is to correct their nonsense. There's a current favorite going around. A chapati. Every chapati is buttered on two sides. Well, traditionally it's not, but maybe it is if you ever see any chapatis. But the idea is that there are two sides to every story, which may be true. And actually, generally, which is quite often, people come to me and complain about someone else or some situation. I tend to reserve judgment until I've heard the other side of the story. But it's not a Shastric truth. It's not that in understanding the nature of reality, there's always another way to look at it, or that all opinions are as good as any other. That's not correct. If that had been correct, then Krishna would not have spoken Bhagavad Gita. If Krishna could have said to Arjuna, well, I don't agree with you, but we can agree to disagree. But how could Krishna agree to disagree with Arjuna if Krishna had agreed to become Arjuna's chariot driver in the battle? What Arjuna was saying, in effect, to Krishna was that, I reject you. Krishna had offered himself to Arjuna to serve Arjuna. Now Arjuna was effectively saying, well, forget it. I don't need your help. It's a wrong idea. You submitted yourself to help me, but that was a wrong idea. In effect, Arjuna is telling Krishna that my idea was wrong, your idea was wrong also. So Arjuna's supposed empathy for the Kauravas works out to be enmity toward his own brothers and toward Krishna. So his idea, be nice to everyone, well, everyone didn't agree with that. And in fact, probably no one on the battlefield would have agreed to that. So he was going against everyone in his so-called goodness. So, this idea that, well, every chapati has two sides, or buttered on two sides, or whatever, this is relativism. Yesterday in the house we visited, I saw in the room a book called Moral Relativism, and the house owner, I mentioned that, and the house owner told me this is a school book. Children have to study all this nonsense in school. The moral relativism, in brief, we could summarize that as saying that, well, it's not difficult to understand that morals are relative to the situation, and that there's no absolute standard of morals. Well, we would agree that morals can be relative to situations, but that there is an absolute standard. According to moral relativism, it could be arguable that Hitler was right, and certainly millions of people at one point agreed that Hitler was right. Moral relativism blurs this distinction between right and wrong. It becomes arbitrary. But even to discuss what is right and what is wrong suggests a metaphysical basis, because the modern anthropological idea that, well, we all just descended from some prototype mammalian species, and therefore we as human beings are simply combinations of chemicals, well, that doesn't support the idea that there's good and bad. Unless good and bad is defined in terms of that which good is pertained as that which pertains to the survival of human bodies. But why should a bag of chemicals how can good or bad apply to a bag of chemicals? If we define ourselves as chemicals, combination of chemicals, then where is the good and where is the bad? Good and bad refer to something that is trans-chemical, because no one laments over the loss of chemicals alone. So this idea that there's no implicit difference between right and wrong, that is, from the absolute standard which we as followers of Shastra are supposed to accept, from the absolute standpoint, that is incorrect and it is wrong. Should we empathize with Ravana? Should Rama have gone to Ravana and had some peace talks and made some deal? Well, you keep her 6 months, I'll keep her 6 months. Something like this. No. Ravana was absolutely 100% wrong. And Rama is absolutely 100% right. And Rama going to Lanka and killing Ravana was absolutely the right thing to do. This Rama, he did not set the example, a bad example to us, of in a case where someone is clearly wrong, that you empathetically listen to him, or you try to understand his reason. Or poor Ravana, maybe he had child abuse in his childhood, and therefore he's misbehaving now. We send him for some psychotherapy and have someone hypnotize him and get him all straightened out. But Rama did the right thing by going and giving Ravana proper punishment. There are people up to the present day who, well, that's a fairly recent thing that came up with this so-called Dravidian movement, who say that actually Ravana was good and Rama was bad. But we have a name for such people from Shastra. Such people are called demons, asuras, rakshasas. It's not that, well, actually, they're all good. In one sense, everyone is good. But as much as we are covered by the demoniac propensity to defy Krishna, then we are bad. That is the ultimate definition of good and of bad. So all this relativizing according to our own egoistic speculations, trying to establish ourselves as being separate from Krishna, it's all Mayavadi nonsense, which leads to a paralysis of the actual intelligence. Our actual intelligence can't even begin to move, just like we heard just after Mangalarti this morning. Srila Prabhupada was speaking to a group of psychologists who are supposed to be very intelligent people and who are supposed to understand the workings of the mind. But despite Srila Prabhupada's repeatedly giving the example of the car and the driver to show that the person in the car is different from the car and more important than the car, in the same way the soul in the body is different from and more important than the body and the mind, and that this is the basis of actual psychology, they couldn't understand it. They couldn't get it. Even though Srila Prabhupada repeatedly gave this example to them, and eventually they grudgingly half admitted, but they said that Srila Prabhupada is asking again and again, which is important, the car or the driver? And say, well, they're both important. They couldn't bring themselves to admit that the temporary body is of no ultimate importance. Because they're attached to their wrong ideas, which form the basis of their attempts for enjoying this material world. Therefore, for all their supposed intelligence, they have intellectual paralysis when it comes to understanding the nature of the soul. And for all their high talk, the French Revolution was, what is it, liberté, égalité, fraternité, a high talk, but at the best, their society is mediocre. At best, if we are driving around this city, world-famous city of Dallas, we see advertisements for steakhouses and adult entertainment, which means pornography, obviously. And just at the best, mediocre. And just actually on this sensual platform, There's nothing to suggest any higher thought, even on the intellectual platform, what to speak of the spiritual platform. So this humanism and all on the basis of the emotions, its sentiment of ignorance, and it produces mediocrity at best and a chaotic condition, actually, in human society, in which no one knows the purpose of life or how to attain it, and apart from social chaos, individual chaos, people are all messed up in their minds. So another Mayavadi nonsense idea, which is much beloved of fans of the interfaith circuit, is to talk about values, human values, spiritual values, without ever defining what they are. They'll use terms like compassion and love, but without defining it. So it all remains nebulous, and we can say, yes, we've got a lot in common with you. You also believe in compassion. We also believe in compassion, but no clear definition of what it is. And they'd all talk compassion, compassion, compassion. Then they'll have their lunch break, and probably at interfaith meetings they don't serve beef or pork, because Hindus and in the past Buddhists also are not supposed to eat beef, and Muslims are not supposed to eat pork, so they probably serve chicken and mutton. In India, mutton means goat's meat, but in this part of the world it means sheep's meat, is it not? You don't know. You're lucky you don't know. People don't eat goats here. You don't see so many goats around here. If there are any goats, they're kept as pets. But in India, goats have a very important religious function, because both Muslims and Hindus kill them on festival days. They're religiously slaughtered. So to talk about values, I just like to talk about compassion, and then without even thinking about it, to kill animals which have been slaughtered without any compassion, unless you include hanging them upside down and slitting their throat so that all the blood comes out of them as compassion. That's a religious way of, supposedly religious way of killing them. Or talking about peace. There's some supposedly great Buddhist leader who goes all over the world talking about peace, and he eats lots of meat every day. So this vague idea of being good, like Arjuna, he had some vague idea of being good without understanding what is the meaning of being good. It makes us all feel very nice. Arjuna must have thought, I'm being very good, I'm being very nice. But Krishna told him that he's a fool and a rascal, because Arjuna had not come to the point of understanding what it means to be good. What it means to be good is to follow Krishna's order, by doing which actual good can accrue to the world. By following our own ideas of what is good, we simply make a big mess in the world. And the evidence of that is planet Earth in the year 2014. So this vague idea of being good, or that religion gives us moral values, but the moral values are increasingly defined by moral relativism instead of by Shastra. There's no absolute standard. Or the moral values supposedly derived from scripture are adjusted according to the prevailing moral values of the broader society. So atheists, they say, well, anyway, you don't need religion to be good. You can be good without religion. But if we don't have a fixed understanding of what is good and what is not good, then What do we need religion for? If religion doesn't give us a clear understanding of what we should do and what we should not do, then we come to the platform, pravritting cha nivritting cha janana vidura suraha. Those who are demoniac do not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. And therefore you get atheists or super atheists who call themselves anti-theists, who write books with titles such as God is not good, and they want to point out that religion has done more harm than good in the world. Because if we define goodness as in some morally relativistic terms, or if we define religion in terms of some tribal culture in which our God supports us, and he's better than your God because he helps us win our wars against you. This kind of understanding or misunderstanding, this will cause chaos in the world. Therefore, Krishna taught Arjuna to understand what is the nature of reality. As long as we're in ignorance, we can mouth platitudes such as listen empathetically and every chapati is buttered on two sides, but without coming to the platform of clear understanding of who we are as spiritual living beings, different from the body, eternal living beings who are trapped in the cycle of birth and death due to our forgetfulness of Krishna. Unless we come to this platform, we'll simply remain on the emotional, sentimental platform, in which at best we can try to do good for others without understanding what it means to do good for others, and more likely we will devolve into the platform, onto the platform of gross exploitation of others. So being stuck on the platform of worldly morality, worldly emotions, on the platform of ignorance, whether one is a so-called religionist or a so-called humanist or moralist, it's all on the platform of ignorance, and it all ultimately encourage everyone just to enjoy this world. And most religionists think that the job of God is to help us enjoy the world, and the atheists say we don't need any God to help us enjoy the world, and they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it if we define enjoying the world in terms of sense gratification. And then comes the question, what do you need God for? Give us this day our daily bread. Well, Monsanto does that, so, or McDonald's does that, so what do we need God for? So-called theism without clear understanding of tattva or the nature of reality, it must devolve into hypocrisy, fanaticism, sentimentalism, exploitation, immorality, and ultimately atheism. And as the atheists point out, it could be better to be an atheist. If worldly morals are our standard, then it could be better to be an atheist than to be a bigoted so-called religionist. And we find that religion, not on the platform of knowledge, it devolves into some simplistic formula such as, well, you just believe in Jesus and Jesus will save you, without any serious effort to understand what are the teachings of Jesus or to follow his teachings. But it's just reduced to a simplistic formula that I believe that Jesus came to save me. And there are many problems with that which the atheists or anti-theists never tire of pointing out. So it's not that we're against values. Of course, we do uphold values, and as Srimad Bhagavatam points out, the very basis of religion as it manifests in this world are the principles of austerity, truthfulness, cleanliness, and mercy. But these are definable, not just something imagined. Srila Prabhupada spoke of values, but he gave specific and clear knowledge, not just some vague idea. For instance, compassion. Compassion means, the basis of compassion is to understand that everyone in this world is suffering due to lack of knowledge of Krishna. Therefore, they should be enlightened, even if they don't want to be. Just like with that group of psychologists who Srila Prabhupada met. He tried to enlighten them. They were not very interested in that. They considered themselves to be very intelligent and educated, and I suspect that they were all trying to psychologically analyze Srila Prabhupada. Because I guess that's what people educated in psychology do. When they meet people, they start to do a psychological assessment of them. Just like people are into astrology, when they meet you, they may say, "Oh, what sign were you born under?" And then they try to work you all out according to astrology. Or someone's into Ayurveda, and they look at your bodily structure, and they think, "Well, he's a Vata type, so he must be like this and like that." And people tend to see others through different lens of their worldly knowledge. So Srila Prabhupada suddenly spoke about values, but in a very clear way, not in a vague manner which leaves it open for the individual to define. This is the whole point, that everything is to be defined and understood from Shastra. And specifically, all values, they derive from dharma. That's an important term which Arjuna invoked to support his proposition not to fight, but Krishna later in this Bhagavad Gita will give Arjuna a proper understanding of dharma. Arjuna had misunderstood the principles of dharma. Unlike the idea of morally relative values, dharma is not arbitrary. It's multifaceted because this world is very complex, but it's not arbitrary. It's all defined according to Shastra. There are rules. There are specific rules. And they're given by the Supreme Controller. Dharmang tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. The rules of dharma are given by Bhagavan himself. It's not something that we can imagine or invent. Of course, we can do, and we can invent certain values, but then we can say that, well, we believe that contraception is very good, because then you don't have unwanted children. But that's not according to Shastra, that's not according to dharma. That's sinful. That's just an example. So it's dharma doesn't give some sentimental, it's quite distinct from the sentimental and misguided ideas which are always subject to be changed according to the values of the society, which are, the values are always changing. And actually in the morally relativistic world, from the standpoint of Shastric morality, it's continually degrading. What they consider to be moral is it's always degrading, such that what was previously considered immoral becomes considered moral, because they have no fixed standard. And we can see that in the Western world there was a time when it was widely considered that contraception was something wrong. But later on, the very churches that opposed contraception came to support it. And the same is true of abortion, although here in America is probably the only country in which there's a long-standing opposition to abortion. But it's widely accepted as being acceptable, whereas there was a time in Western society when there was a widespread, practically universal revulsion against it. And there are many other examples. how moral relativism means there's no fixed standard of morality. Just what group consensus, what people consider to be right. But then people are interested in sense gratification. How can they have a clear understanding of what is right and what is wrong without understanding what is our actual purpose in this world? We cannot understand what is right and what is wrong. That was the problem with Arjuna. That's why we had to go beyond chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita. That Arjuna, he wanted to be good, he wanted to be right, but he didn't have clear understanding of his actual purpose in the world, and therefore he was wrong. Everything came out wrong. So the rules have to be given by God. Otherwise, we find, for instance, I mean, there are so many examples, but one example is that Srila Prabhupada often pointed out that in the modern Western world, they lavish affection on dogs and kill by the millions cows. It's a distorted society in which the dog, which is some use to human society, in as much as can be a watchdog, or it can be trained for other things also, the dogs. But most people just keep a dog because they find it much easier to make a friendship with a dog than with human beings. But that's an aberration in human society, because people don't get on with each other. They prefer that the dog comes and licks them and they feel very happy. But in the meantime, the cows are being slaughtered by the millions. So that is... Even from the morally relativistic point of view, if we consider that cows are just some animal and dogs are just some animal, then why be so kind to dogs and why so cruel to cows? Where's the logic in that? So we should go beyond the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita and not lament with Arjuna, but become enlightened by Krishna. And we'll understand what an uncompromising message Krishna gave to Arjuna. He didn't want Arjuna to remain in ignorance. And actually Arjuna, who is lamenting being on the platform of his sentimental so-called values, by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, he was in good spirit. He was happy, because he was ready to follow Krishna's ideas instead of his own concocted ideas. And the result of all that, instead of Arjuna's peace plan, literally millions of people were killed on the battlefield. We should send all the people who are going to peace conferences and tell them about the Battle of Kurukshetra. Well, they probably wouldn't be able to appreciate it. It was a terrible war. At one point, there was so much blood being spattered all around it, mixed with all the dust, and precipitated, and there was a rain of blood. Well, that's what war is like. It's not pleasant, but it is sometimes required. Such ghastliness is required because people are rejecting Krishna. Pools of blood condensed or evaporated, and then came down as rain of blood while all the people were fighting. So we find also that when Srila Prabhupada was preaching in America, the Vietnam War was going on. And the young people who are coming to Srila Prabhupada presumed that Srila Prabhupada would be against the Vietnam War. But Srila Prabhupada said, well, it's part of life in this material world. That you voted in the government, and now if the government tells you to go and fight, how can you protest? Srila Prabhupada wasn't against the war per se. He was teaching Bhagavad Gita, which was Krishna's admonition to Arjuna to go and fight in a war. That was a good analogy for him to teach the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, that one has to follow a higher authority. So one reason so many young people came to Srila Prabhupada was because they were disaffected with the materialistic society in which they were living. But on that principle of although the Vietnam War was undoubtedly a demoniac war fought between two parties of demons, but Srila Prabhupada upheld that, well, it's your country, you take benefit from the country, so if the country calls you to fight, then how can you protest? He wasn't against it per se, which shocked many of the people coming to listen to him. So the point here is that this relativistic morality, that can never actually benefit us, and it was to save Arjuna from that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita and gave Arjuna a clear understanding of reality as it is. It may seem very harsh to us, but actually the alternative, the repeated birth and death in this material world, is extremely harsh. So there are a few thoughts about that, and if there are any questions now, please ask or comments.
Can you clarify the what you're saying regarding contraception and unwanted children? Is it really better to have lots of unwanted children than it is to use contraception?
Is it better to have lots of unwanted children than to use contraception? It's something like asking, is it better to smash someone on the head with an iron bar or with a gold bar?
The question
is all such as this. Neither are good alternatives. Both are sinful. Human life means there should be sense control. Without sense control, it's animal life. So if we think, I'll live like an animal, but I'll use contraceptives to stop producing more animals, that also amounts to, according to Shastra, that's one kind of murder, because it prevents the chance for the living being to take human body. It's equated with abortion, as being on the same level. Bruhatya is the technical term. Means murder of the embryo.
So according to Shastra, if somebody's very sexually overindulgent, it's still better to have unwanted children than it is to use contraception.
Well, again, if you're going to be sinful, which is the better way to be sinful? It's not really the right question to ask.
I think it would be better to carry the bigger burden on yourself rather than.
Yeah, you think, but unfortunately for you, or what you think doesn't. Is not the level, is not the measure of reality. But, that is the... One should take... If one is to act sinfully, one should take responsibility for one's actions also. So if one engages in the sexual act, then people say it's natural to have sex. Well, it's also natural to have children. So... Children should be allowed to be born. And then it's proper to look after them also. This feminist movement, Srila Prabhupada analyzed that the idea of giving women freedom it's an opportunity for the men to use them and throw them with no responsibility. Of course, now with DNA testing, it can be found out who the father was. But that's the idea that we can use as many women as you like, and then if they get pregnant, they can get an abortion, or if they have a child, well, it's their problem. But the institution of marriage is there So that one reason for it is that men take responsibility for their sexual act. Yeah, anything else? No, all right, Hare Krishna.